you that are guests, this is Science in the Bible, a course we're going through. We're in the seventh chapter of Genesis, and we're now looking at evidences, biblical evidences, for a universal flood that is not global. For those of you who were at the Chia Convention last week, we got through three of those evidences. We'll be moving on, and I'm going to kind of review that by asking a few questions of all of you. Before I do that, though, let me give a quick report on the Origin of Life Conference that was sponsored by the International Society for Studies on the Origin of Life. This is a conference that Dr. Fuzz Ron and myself got to attend last week. Fuzz was there for the entire week. I was there for two of the 5 days of that conference. Well, we made a commitment to attend the conference because we're going to be writing a book on the origin of life. The last book written on the origin of life from a Christian perspective was by Walter Bradley, Charles Saxon, and Roger Olson, written in 1983. And a lot has happened since 1983, so we feel it's time to develop a new text on the origin of life. And this really is the only conference that's ever held on the origin of life by the researchers, and they only meet once every 3 years. And since they were meeting in San Diego, it was not that hard for us to get down there. And it was interesting for me to discover that about half of all the researchers in the origin of life either work in the Pasadena area or the San Diego area. So, again, we have the resources right here to tap into the different researchers as we write the book. And this conference, as I said, is the only one of its kind. It's only held once every 3 years. And everybody in the field does attend the conference. So it's a great way to meet all the principals in just one event. But the one thing we noticed is the attendance was down. There were fewer than 300 people there, and this was a conference that in this heyday would draw close to 1,000 people. And the other thing we noticed is that the participants tended to be graduate students sponsored by NASA fellowships. NASA's got a huge chunk of money to sponsor internships, and one of the requirements is that the interns have to attend the conference. So that made up about half of the attendees. And the other thing that really struck Fuzz and I is that the rest of the participants are clearly dominated by people in their 60s and 70s. What's missing are the researchers in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. And that kind of indicates that the federal funding agencies have finally figured out this is an area that's not producing results. And hey, if you're a scientist in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, you've got to be able to produce some results. Those in the 60s, they are sufficiently secure, they can kind of do anything they want. Young graduate students haven't figured it out yet, so and they're getting money to attend these things. And it was really the only conference I've been to where you just saw that hole in the ages of the participants. The other thing that got to us, really right from the very beginning, is that the researchers in the origin of life are finally beginning to experience some depression and pessimism from their lack of results. When I say lack of results, there's some very good stuff coming out of the research, but it's lack of results in terms of those looking at it from a naturalist perspective. And we were probably the only two participants there that weren't looking at the origin of life from a naturalist perspective. So they're feeling depressed and pessimistic because their naturalistic model just isn't working. And as we talked to the participants, it was like, well, you know, you must do science from a naturalist perspective. That's the only way it can be done. And the whole idea that, science could be done with something other than a naturalist perspective is clearly an idea that hadn't even occurred to them. They had just been taught that's the rules of science. Nobody had ever questioned those rules of science. And I think it also bore out to Fuzz and I that there's a real problem in the fact that people getting PhDs in science typically are not being exposed to the historical roots of science. But it's really only recently, just this century, that science was captured by the naturalists, and students were taught that that was really the only way that science could be done. But if you go back previous to this century, that definitely wasn't the case. And go back into the 1700s even more so. So there just seems to be this lack of perception that, you know, we must do it this way because that's the rules of the game. Well, where did the rules come from? And when you discover that the rules all came from philosophers, not scientists, then suddenly, you know, we have a more open perspective. So let me just give you a little report on what kind of heightened the pessimism. I mean, there are plenty of reasons for pessimism even before the conference got going. But one of the first papers that was presented was by a fellow who said, you know, this oxygen problem we've been worrying about for the last 10 years is probably more severe than we've acknowledged. And what he was pointing out is that the radiation from potassium decay, thorium decay, and uranium decay was such that it would guarantee a constant production of oxygen in the oceans. And that oxygen produced in the oceans inevitably would cause free oxygen to appear in the atmosphere. Now, this is before, you know, any life would exist. I mean, kind of a reigning paradigm is you don't get oxygen until you get photosynthetic plants. But this gentleman pointed out that there are inorganic processes on Earth that would demand that you would get significant quantities of oxygen. Now, when I say significant, I'm only talking like 2%. But keep in mind, in terms of origin of life chemistry, even the tiniest amount of oxygen kills any possibility for these amino acids and nucleotides to come together. It just isn't going to happen if you've got the slightest amount of a molecular oxygen hanging around, either in the atmosphere or the ocean. And now there's a recognition that just the decay of uranium, potassium, and thorium by itself is adequate to produce a rather large amount of oxygen. And it was interesting watching the response when this guy finished his paper. Everybody said, isn't there some way we can get rid of this uranium, thorium? And no, I mean, it's in the earth. And moreover, this stuff is, the energy from the radiation was at least five times more intense. When you go back to the date for the origin of life of, say, 3.9 billion years ago, there's no way to get rid of it. And so it immediately brought about amongst the audience, well, we've got to look somewhere else. There was a question over here, Wes. Well, if you get enough oxygen in the water, it inevitably will make it into the atmosphere. And so, yeah, just this radiation from the Earth's crust is going to produce this oxygen in the ocean, and it's going to get up into the atmosphere, which means there's going to be no possibility for the prebiotic molecular reactions that are necessary for the origin of life. Which led one guy to speculate. He says, well, I guess we're stuck on this, but maybe we can go to volcanic vents. And in volcanic vents, we might get a total lack of oxygen. But it was interesting. The very next paper was a guy who got up and said the outgassing from volcanoes is not, methane and ammonia. It's carbon dioxide and water. And this goes all the way back. Again, he had proof that this goes all the way back four and a half billion years ago. So he says, you know, that's not going to work either. Yes. Well, yeah, the first life forms, unlike us, were able to handle more radiation. I mean, that's one of the reasons why God could not create human beings 3 billion years ago. He could make bacteria. He could make algae, but he couldn't make human beings because the radiation was so intense. And so what we have is God biding his time until the radiation subsided enough that we can make it. And even so, radiation is a huge factor on how long we live here on this planet. So the reason we only make it to 70, 80, 90 years is we live in a radiation environment. And so, but there are other reasons why God creates us last. By creating us last, we get to come upon the scene in not only the safest environment for human life, but also in the richest environment for human life. Coming on the scene after 3.9 billion years of previous life history has a huge advantage for fostering human civilization. That means we've got literally trillions of tons of biodeposits that we can exploit to develop a civilization. And that was essential from a theological perspective, because God's intent was that the good news of Jesus Christ would be spread rapidly and not slowly. And that meant that we had to have access to civilization and technology, and that requires that we have access to billions of years of biodeposits accumulated in the crust. And also, human life doesn't really do well unless we have a lot of biodiversity. And that biodiversity takes time to accumulate on the face of the earth, because the earth can only support 20, 30, 40 million species at a time. And for human life, you really want a good billion species preceding us, which means you're going to need some time to make all that happen. Yes, Mike. Right. Yes, what's interesting about Earth is we have the largest dose of those radiometric elements. And so, yeah, this oxygen production is especially intense on Earth. And you also need a planet that has, stable oceans. At the very last day, there was a bunch of papers presented on Mars and how we have all this evidence for water on Mars, liquid water on Mars. However, all that evidence is limited to only the most ancient rocks on Mars. The earliest evidence they've seen is 3.85 billion years ago, and really begins to disappear by about 4 billion years ago. In fact, what was happening in those papers on Mars is the recognition that liquid water existed for only the briefest period of time in the Martian history. And everybody gets excited about liquid water. We need to realize that water is the most abundant molecule in outer space. There is no molecule that's more abundant than water. Water is everywhere in the universe. What's rare is to get liquid water in a stable state. You're going to get liquid water in different places of the universe, but the problem is it takes special conditions for that water to remain. And so it's no big deal that Mars had a lot of water. It would have to have a lot of water. I mean, the early history of the universe, you had all these comets raining down upon solar system bodies. And what are comets? Essentially ice balls. We call them dirty ice balls. And so they would bring a lot of water. And so Mars would have all this water. But what we see in the geological features of Mars is that the water disappeared quickly. It was there. You see the flow channels. You see the erosion. But the geological evidence is it left very quickly. And the gravity of Mars being only 0.38 that of the Earth, yes, it would dissipate to outer space fairly quickly. It evaporates quickly. There had to be a large quantity of water on the Earth at one time. The big unsolved problem is one guy got up there and said, we think we know what warmed the planet up. He was appealing to carbon dioxide clouds, etc. But I noticed James Casting got up right afterwards and said, we have evidence that the clouds were never that thick. And therefore, he says, I'm convinced there was a lot of liquid water on Mars at one time, but we still don't know what it is that warmed up the planet enough to turn it from a frozen state to a liquid state. But that's kind of the scenario. You had all this frozen water on Mars. Some event warmed it all up, it melted, you got all this erosion going on, and then it disappeared relatively quickly. And then with the atmosphere thinning out on Mars, as it would, its gravity is such that it would thin out fairly quickly. Once it thins out, then we have the problem that the freezing point of water is identical to the boiling point. So you got the same boiling point for water on Mars is freezing point. That's why there's no liquid water on Mars today. There is water on Mars, but because the freezing point's the same as the boiling point, it never remains in the liquid state. So, anyway, as I got a little bit ahead of myself there, but yeah. Don't understand what can happen. Okay, I probably jumped a little bit ahead of you. How many of you have been backpacking in the high Sierras? Okay. What happens when you backpack an ice here? You cook up a little or boil up a little pot of coffee or hot chocolate or whatever, and you discover when you drink it, it's only tepid. It doesn't get as hot as it does here at sea level because the air pressure is less. Okay, the air pressure on Mars is so low that the boiling point of the water drops down to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's what's going on. And that's why you never have it in the liquid state. Never is a bit strong. I mean, there are conditions on Mars that sometimes get favorable enough, occasionally get favorable enough, that a liquid drop of water can last 1 second. Wow, right? Not quite enough for light. So that's why you take a pressure cooker with you and you go backpacking. That's a good idea. So the ice caps of Mars are made up of carbon dioxide mostly, but a little bit of water. But that's what you notice. The water doesn't melt from the Martian polar caps. It immediately goes into the vaporous state. Goes in the vaporous state, it disappears to outer space. So why is there water on Mars today? Because Mars gets water replenished. You still have comets falling on the surface of Mars. They bring water. Water leaves. What we have on Mars today is an equilibrium situation. The rate at which water comes down is balanced by the rate at which water leaves, but the bottom line is there's not much water there, period. It's a very dry planet. Okay, in addition to the oxygen problem that was noted and the fact that steam vents aren't going to work, and by the way, it was like 30 years ago that Stanley Miller made the point that nucleotides will not be stable anywhere near a steam vent. So this whole idea that underwater steam vents are going to work, you do not get stable nucleotides, the bases of the DNA and the RNA in that kind of environment. And by the way, if you want to get the proteins coming together, you need a dry environment. As far as I know, deep ocean sea vents are not dry. So all this speculation there is also closed up. Yes. Plate tectonics in the early history of the Earth was much more intense than it is today. And that's another reason why you can't have birds and mammals billions of years ago. And they're not going to be able to handle the tectonics. They're not going to be able to handle the radiation. They're not going to be able to handle the increased volcanism that would result from that radiation. But the bacteria can handle it. Okay, in the early history of the Earth, you've got lots of oxygen to stop the synthesis of these prebiotics into organic molecules. And so even the tiniest amount of oxygen will stop that process. And that's one reason why I'm saying you need a creator to explain why you have life on planet Earth, because the natural chemistry simply won't permit it. You need someone actually designing these life things supernaturally to make it happen. But in terms of the conditions of the Earth, yes, 3-4 billion years ago, there was oxygen, but not enough oxygen for birds and mammals. We're talking 2-2.5% oxygen in the atmosphere, and what you need for birds and mammals is a minimum of 15%. And so you say, where did that change from 2.5% to 15% to 21% come from? Photosynthetic plants. And so, as you see in Genesis chapter 1, on the third day, God creates these plants. The animals that need lots of oxygen come on the fifth and sixth creation days. By that time, the plants would have boosted that 2.5% oxygen up to 21%, and now it's possible for people like us to live upon the surface of the Earth. 3 billion years ago, we couldn't make it. But the bacteria and the algae could do quite well. There's another reason. Well, there's lots of reasons, by the way. It literally takes 3 billion years for the soil of planet Earth to be prepared for advanced flowering plants. So just the recognition that you need this synergy between the algae, the bacteria, and the fungi working for 3 billion years before you get a soil that can possibly support the plants that we need to survive. Yes. Okay. Yeah, there's been some speculation that maybe in the days of the dinosaurs there was a little more oxygen. That was a rumor that was spread about 3-4 years ago. And we now realize that that's not true. We have the geophysical measurements to establish the oxygen content was roughly the same as it is. But yeah, if you boost the oxygen content up, the problem is that birds and mammals begin to respirate too efficiently. I think in Japan they have these oxygen bars where you can walk in and get an oxygen boost and you feel really great. Well, you don't want to overdo that. There were experiments done after World War II, not by design but by accident, on the fighter pilots where they would feed them pure oxygen when they were running around with their jet aircraft. And I remember growing up in that era. And we knew a lot of jet fighter pilots in the Canadian Air Force, and none of them made it to age 50. The oxygen they were fed was such that it wore their bodies out very rapidly. So, yeah, you don't want to have too much oxygen. And we see in our atmosphere of about 21% really is ideal. By the way, there's another problem, perhaps a more severe problem. If you were to push the oxygen content up even by 1%, that greatly increases the incidence of forest and grass fires. Things burn more easily. And so if you don't have enough oxygen, then we're not able to perform the work that's necessary to maintain the level of activity that God intended. But if you push it up too high, then everything starts burning. And from one standpoint, that would include us. If you take in too much oxygen, you burn up a little too quickly. Yes. Well, this is a whole other issue, you know, just how do you maintain the delicate balances on Earth that are necessary for life. And you notice in the popular press, carbon dioxide is getting a lot more attention than oxygen. And the reason is that, once you push the oxygen content up a little bit, things begin to oxidize more efficiently. And so that will tend to bring the oxygen content down. What you're really doing is moving oxygen from the atmosphere into the crust. So, when you burn up forests, that oxygen goes into the ashes, iron rust, that kind of thing. And also, there's really a huge amount of oxygen in the atmosphere already. And so human activity really doesn't do that much to affect the oxygen content. I mean, we can be burning all the fossil fuels we want. It really has little effect on the oxygen content of the atmosphere. Why? Because there's already such a huge tonnage of oxygen in the atmosphere. Our anthropogenic activities really don't affect the total percentage by that much. On the other hand, we've got 21% oxygen in the atmosphere. We have 0.03% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so human activity has a potential to change the percentage of carbon dioxide much more dramatically than it does the oxygen. And so, yeah, when you burn coal, you release a lot of carbon dioxide. And really the only thing that's taking that out are the plants. Plants consume that. But if you're knocking down all the forests and paving them over with concrete and blacktop, then that tends to make it worse. You're not only burning more or putting more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you're preventing the consumption of that carbon dioxide. That's why there's this big campaign to plant trees. So, well, of course it affects oxygen, but in terms of the percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere, it has very little effect. Whereas for carbon dioxide, it's a huge effect because there's very little of it in the atmosphere to start with. So, yes.
How long do you think it would take for the average naturalistic scientist, most of them, to come to the realization that this is a failed?
Well, attending this conference gives me a lot more optimism for that, because what I saw is by the end of the first day, people had given up on the origin of life on the surface of planet Earth. They said, the oxygen makes it impossible. And so the whole rest of the conference was focused on, we got to do it in outer space. Okay? It's not going to happen on Earth. And so I didn't hear anyone question the conclusion that it can't work on Earth. They now know it can't work on Earth. And so now all the energy is focused on, let's see if we can figure out how it could happen in outer space. Now, there is a lot of papers dealing with the Murchison meteorite. That's a big meteor that fell in Australia many decades ago. And what's giving us a lot of attention on that meteorite, they have found amino acids in the meteorite. And they have found a few other, what they call, you have to watch the terminology. They keep saying, we have found organic molecules. It'd be more accurate to say they have found prebiotic molecules. They haven't found any proteins, no DNA, no RNA, nothing that we would recognize as biological molecules. What they're finding are the simple building blocks of those molecules. And so the fact that they have found formaldehyde in outer space, methanol, they have found hydrogen cyanide, HCN. So, in fact, they've now discovered about 100 different, what they call biological molecules in outer space. But what you need to do is read the fine print. 99.9% of what they have found is water, carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide. And they still call those biotic molecules. I mean, they're extremely common in the universe. The rest of it, the other 97 molecules they have found, have to fit in that 0.1%. And in no case are those molecules very complicated. I mean, methanol is kind of at the very top of the heap. They have found a few amino acids. And that's what's generating all the enthusiasm. They say, well, gee, maybe we have a rain of amino acids from outer space falling to the surface of the Earth. I didn't hear anybody make any mention, however, of the fact that we have no evidence for sugars, no evidence for nucleotides. And, we have no mechanism on Earth for naturally producing nucleotides or sugars. And we don't see them in outer space either. Nowhere in outer space do we see sugars. Nowhere in outer space do we see nucleotides. So that's a huge problem because you're not going to make it with just the amino acids. But I'll tell you what's driving all the enthusiasm. They saw in this Murchison meteorite a slight tendency towards left-handedness in a few of the amino acids. Not all of them, but a few. And they said, well, these are the amino acids that don't show up in life molecules, so this must be the signature of some real process in outer space that makes these molecules left-handed rather than right-handed. Okay, some of the fine print. All we're seeing is a few percent excess. We're talking something like 55% left-handed to 45% right-handed. Life needs 100% left-handed. 45-55 mixture won't do. And then they've been kind of scratching their heads saying, well, where in the universe can we get this tendency towards left-handedness? And the only thing they've been able to identify is ultraviolet circularly polarized light. Laboratory experiments do demonstrate that will show a slight tendency towards shifting it from a right-handed, left-handed mixture of 50-50 to very slightly left-handed. And then they found that there were some circularly polarized light in the Orion Nebula, and they said, that's the star-forming region, there we go. Okay, again, the footnote is what they found was infrared radiation, not ultraviolet, but infrared. And the other very significant fine point, it doesn't work unless the circularly polarized light is monochromatic, What that means is all of circularly polarized light comes out of only one wavelength. Nowhere in the universe do we have any source that produces monochromatic circularly polarized light. So again, they come up with nothing. And then the question is, well then why is this Murchison meteorite showing a slight excess of left-handedness? Several gentlemen got up and said, you know, contamination. This thing's been around for 30 years. And we should have been suspicious all along because it's the only meteorite that shows this result. The other meteorites don't show that result. And you know, all this enthusiasm about these meteorites from Mars, one guy got up there and said, guess what, guys, all 14 of them are contaminated. Because, you know, David Mackay was very enthusiastic. He says, well, yeah, I kind of made a mistake on this ALH84001 that he got Bill Clinton dancing all around the microphone about. He says, well, I now concede that there's nothing there. But he was making a big case for this thing that he found in Egypt. And then the guy got up and followed him and said, well, now, in terms of ALH84001, the killer was that the ratio of amino acids we found in that meteorite were identical to the ratio of amino acids we see in Antarctic meltwater. And that thing was found in Antarctica. And he says, now when we look at this Egyptian thing, the ratio of amino acids is different, but guess what? It's identical to the ratio we see in Nile Delta silt, which is where the thing was found. And he says, and then he gave some calculations on how quickly these meteorites would be invaded by terrestrial contaminants. And he says, we're talking days before this thing. So he says, we can forget about all these, because there's a huge effort to look for more meteorites from Mars. And he says, we may as well forget it. They're going to be, anything we find will be contaminated. So, unless we catch them. Well, what's really going on is they're saying, we have to go to Mars. So now that's kind of fueling. I mean, you know, forget about looking forward on Earth. In fact, some of them are very excited and say, you know, we really wanted to go to Mars all along anyway. I mean, who wants to go to Antarctica? So let's go to Mars. And now that we know that Antarctica is a non-option, that should give us more arguments to encourage the taxpayer to fund some journeys to Mars.
Are they doing this to avoid the flood to bring it back?
Bring it back to Genesis, or are they doing this to avoid the flood? Okay, I'll try to wrap this up quickly. So I catch your point.
Do you and Fuzz have any input at all?
Well, you know, Fuzz and I were tempted many times to go up to the microphone because I, you know, nobody brought up the monochromatic problem. And this guy, this lady was up there from Italy, and she's saying, you know, we have a real result. And yes, I'm aware of this paper in Nature. It's very critical of my claim that this is a real result and not contamination. And she glossed completely over the monochromatic thing, which is the main point of Mason's paper. I had the paper right in front of me. What I did is I looked around and said, I wonder how many other people here have the paper. Nobody had the paper. So I was real tempted. We know what Buzz and I made an agreement ahead of time. We're not going to go to the microphone because we're here to do research for our book. And if we go to the microphone, that stops some other skeptic from going to the microphone and talking about something we may know nothing about. And there were lots of people who wanted to go to the microphone and express their skepticism. So we're going to keep quiet. Because if we go up there, then we'll have less material for our book rather than more material. But I also wanted to observe, you know, just how perceptive these people were at what I thought were obvious criticism. That was a prime example where the main point in the paper of criticism was completely glossed over and nobody picked up on it. So I thought that was quite interesting. The other thing that Fuzz and I did as an experiment says, let's keep a low profile and see what happens. Because all of us, you know, Fuzz and I were wearing these big nameplates. And it had our name on it and our sponsoring institution, Reasons to Believe, in big letters. So as we were walking around the campus, we wanted to see how many people are going to wonder what this Reasons to Believe is all about. All we saw were lots of people staring at our name tags and quickly beating a hasty retreat. Only one guy approached us. And he came up to me and said, I watch your television show on a regular basis. So he was just saying how much he enjoyed it and said, he asked us, you know, why we were there. And so we told them why we were there. In fact, we said, you know, if anybody asks us, we're going to tell them exactly why we're there. But what I thought was interesting, nobody wanted to ask us why we were there. So, but this one guy did make the point. He says, you know, I'm real impressed with the fact that you're the only creationists that are here. You think all the creationist organizations would attend this conference. That says, I find it very interesting that you're the only ones that are here. Especially since we're right in the backyard of the Institute of Creation Research. They didn't come. We were there. So, yes. Yeah, well, that paper I was referring to in Nature by Mason, he makes that point. He says your spectroscopic resolution simply isn't adequate to produce the claim that you're making. And that's what this lady from Italy, she picked up on that one and said, you know what, Mason's wrong. We have plenty of resolution. But she ignored the monochromatic point, which I thought was a stronger rebuttal in Mason's paper. And then, by the way, another guy got up afterwards and said, you know, the very experiments that you perform on the meteorite themselves will generate an excess of lead-tan and amino acids. What he was doing was saying, you know, we can make things non-racemic in the laboratory. We can take a bunch of sugars or amino acids that are 50-50 left-handed and right-handed, and we know how to set up laboratory conditions so that we can select out the left-handed against the right-handed. And one guy got up and said the very methods used to do the spectroscopic analysis will set up that sequence to a very slight degree. And so again, he said, there's human contamination is going on here.
With the probabilities of life coming to be by naturalistic means so astronomically low, even if you get 45 or 55, what difference does it make? I mean, it seems like you still got to lean out all the 45 right.
Well, I'll tell you what they were saying about that. They said, you know, we know how to do this in the lab. Since we know to do this in the lab, maybe it can happen in nature. But the truth of the matter is, yeah, we can make it happen in the lab, but boy, we got to put a lot of engineering effort into it. And if we're not scrupulously clean about how we do the experimental chemistry, then we're not going to get. I mean, if what you really have to do is very carefully isolate the ones that you want. Because what will happen, you know, the way amino acids work, they have a very strong tendency to return to a 50-50 mixture. So if you leave them alone at any time, you're in trouble. And how they get, say, a sample 80% left-handed is they just make sure the stuff that gets left-handed gets protected from this kind of destruction. And so, again, it takes a lot of care and design on behalf of the chemists to make this work. And nobody there was claiming this was going to happen in nature, but they were saying, you know, we do it in the lab, maybe there's some unknown way, but it's never been seen in nature. There's nothing on the surface of the Earth today that is allowing that to happen under natural conditions.
My point is, like, I'm willing to give them, okay, suppose this meteor is 55 left-handed, 45 right-handed. What does that do for you?
It does nothing. You got to get it to 100%. Well, I'll give you an idea of the kind of the mood of desperation there. Towards the, on the very last day, this guy got up and said, maybe we ought to look for life chemistry that doesn't need homochirality. And, you know, that's a symptom of a desperate statement in the sense that they realize the homochirality and problem is impossible from a naturalistic perspective. And now they're going so far to say is, maybe we can do it. No, they're not going to be able to do it with amino acids because, you know, the whole problem is they have to all, kind of like Legos, if you don't line them up all a certain way, you're not going to be able to put them together. And so what this gentleman was really saying is maybe there's some mystery molecule that doesn't have this problem of left-handed and right-handed, and we can connect them together more easily without having to worry about getting them all oriented the same way. Well, no, I think, yeah. But the whole problem is there is no candidate. There is no candidate molecule out there that would have that property, and if there was, you'd have to explain how, why life got started on a molecular base where you don't have this left-handed to right-handed property and somehow switch to adopting amino acids and nucleotide sugars. So that's what they're really saying, that we can make all these complex molecules without sugars, without amino acids, and once that happens, it switches over to amino acids and sugars. But they have no candidate, and they certainly have no mechanism to explain the switch from one to the other, particularly since it's got to happen really quickly. I mean, that's one of another reasons why they abandoned the idea that it was happening on Earth, because we now have evidence that life was abundant on Earth back to 3.86 billion years. And before 3.86 billion years, the bombardment of asteroids and comets on planet Earth was so intense as to permanently sterilize the planet. So it's like once that bombardment subsides just enough to make it possible, you instantly have life. And so the recognition that life happened in an instant on the surface of the Earth, this kind of came out later on in the conference. They said, you know, it's not enough that we get amino acids from outer space. It's not enough that we get sugars and nucleotides from outer space. It's not even enough that they come here on the surface of the Earth all linked up together. What we need, because of the fact that it's such an incredibly brief period of time between when it was impossible and when it was barely possible, we need fully formed bacteria coming to us from outer space. And so now that's the revival of the panspermia idea, that it didn't happen here on Earth. Somewhere out in outer space, bacteria were made, and then they got moved from there to the surface of the Earth. The whole problem with that is it's impossible to move bacteria through outer space without destroying them. The light that you would need to move them is so intense, it would immediately break down the bacteria. Hey, it's even strong enough that it would break down the amino acids and nucleotides. So again, everywhere you look in this origin of life, dead end, dead end, dead end, dead end. And there wasn't one glimmer of optimism at the conference that we even had a possible non-dead end option. I think that's what impressed Fuzz and I. Everything that we heard, there wasn't even the possibility suggested of a non-dead end situation. Yeah, Mike? Would any planet with oceans have a problem with oxygen in the atmosphere, and if not, why not? Yeah, if you had a whole lot less radiation, then you could have a lot less uranium, a lot less potassium and thorium. Potassium and uranium, thorium's not that important, but uranium and potassium are. Well, the potassium's a killer. I mean, you can imagine situations in the universe, like, for example, the moon doesn't have much uranium or thorium, but it does have radioactive potassium. And, the potassium is universal. So, and that is the prime contributor to oxygen coming up in the primordial oceans of the Earth. So, it'd be a universal problem. I mean, you know, from my perspective, once you prove it's impossible on Earth, you've proved it's impossible everywhere, because there's nowhere else in the universe where conditions are going to be any better. Yes?
At the conference, do they have any confirmation of their conditions that they're looking for? Do they evaluate as many as reasons that the necessary conditions for them?
Well, you know, this was interesting from my perspective of trying to accumulate these evidences. There were two individuals at the conference, Jeffrey Botta, and I'm trying to think of the name, you know, I've already mentioned him, James Castings. And Botta and Castings by themselves have been responsible for generating about a dozen of the design characteristics that we talk about in our materials. And so I assumed that these two gentlemen were theists. They weren't. What I discovered was that they had produced these design evidences even though they were doing everything to try to get rid of the design evidences. They weren't looking for those design evidences, and it was obvious that the paper is that they were doing everything they could to make the parameters broader for the acceptance of life rather than towards a narrower point. So they were discovering these design evidences in spite of their philosophical biases. Well, in one sense, that makes our argument these evidences when they're trying to get rid of them and just finding themselves. And that's the other thing about Botta and I keep trying to think of the other guy's name, Castings. The more research they do, the narrower their parameters become by their own admission. So,
do they resent you using their work?
No, no. They know lots of people use the work. I was very impressed by both Castings and Botta. I thought they were probably the two best researchers at the conference. And the two that were the most honest about the results and the fact that we got problems. And but I noticed they're a little bit broader in their research than just the origin of life. So the fact that the origin of life is not producing no results doesn't stop them from producing results because they have broader research interests. Scripps Institute, UCSD, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Caltech. So, yeah, that's they're local guys. Yes.
Well, the carbohydrate or the sugar portion of supplying the, where are they supposed to be getting these sugars from?
Well, the sugar problem is unsolved. There's nowhere in outer space where we see sugars. We don't see nucleotides either.
We couldn't without the sugars
anyway. Yeah.
So it's with the some things of sugars in outer space that presupposes chlorophyll, which is a very complex molecule, very much used too.
Well, there's been some thought that maybe you can get sugars without chlorophyll, but you know, yeah, and that really is
a good example. Some very stuff.
Yep, and trying to do it in outer space is all the worse. So, I mean, you know, to the extent that some of these people are going to is saying, well, you know, neutron stars have really strange energy spectra. You know, maybe there's some chemistry going on there we don't understand. But you know, once they start appealing to neutron star environments, they say, you know, something's wrong here. That's about the worst place you can go for that kind of chemistry to take place. But it just, again, shows the desperation that's going on there. So, yeah.
This discussion has all been about finding the right conditions. Was at the conference, was the complexity of even the simplest cell addressed at all? Or
not at all.
It was just working on conditions. They haven't got to the, even if the stuff was there,
there wasn't a single paper on the problem of getting amino acids to come together to make proteins or getting the nucleotides and sugars together to make RNA and DNA. They said, we got much more fundamental problems. How do we even get the building blocks to get this whole thing going? Right, right. And you know, and the fact that you can't make it work on Earth by natural means and they're going to outer space and that's it. I mean, and, you know, the last paper presented was, well, you know, the bacteria come to us fully formed and viable from outer space. But then, you know, where do you make these bacteria in outer space?
In
and how do they get here?
At the Romulan Empire.
At the Romulan Empire, right? Well, I mean, even that was suggested that maybe, not Romulan explicitly, but the idea that, because there's a transport problem. If you got a bacteria somehow produced on planet X, how do you get that bacteria from planet X to planet Earth? And the recognition is it can't happen. They're just, any radiation strong enough to move it will kill it. Not only kill it, it'll even break down the amino acids and the nucleotides. So that's not going to work. And so finally they said, well, what's really going on is there's some intelligent society out there that has gone around the cosmos and realized Earth is a great zoo. And so what they've done is they've actually used a spacecraft to come here and salt the planet with these primitive life forms. And then because they're curious, they're watching Earth evolve. Okay, that. Well, again, it's a symptom of the spirit of desperation that they're willing to even go so far as to say. And then, of course, the whole problem is, well, you know, isn't it going to be a lot harder to make an intelligent race on another planet than it is to make a bacterium? So, and by the way, it's not that easy for even intelligent societies with infinite resources to move stuff from there to here. Space travel is not as easy as what our TV science fiction movies describe. So, okay. Yeah.
I tried.
You tried. All right. Okay. Well, let me just say one thing I thought was effective from this conference is, and again, it's on the last day. You know, there's a whole lot of enthusiasm about Europa, because Europa might have an ocean. But they now know that if it has a liquid ocean, it's about 20 kilometers below a frozen crust on Europa. And so this one guy got up and said, well, how are you going to drill the hole? And the guy says, oh, we got about all that worked out. What we're going to do is take a bit of highly radioactive material, and we're going to just let that thing eat its way through the ice, and then we'll drop this little robot down the hole. It'll swim around and take pictures of bacteria, and it'll find its way back to the hole, and we'll just pull it up the hole, and we'll take it back to Earth, and, you know, we'll look at the photos and analyze the samples it's found. But this one guy got up and said, you know, we haven't even done that on the Arctic Ocean yet. And, yeah, JPL I really appreciate, because they're getting a lot more practical about these things and saying, you know, 20 years ago what NASA would do, they would do the experiment for the first time in some extraterrestrial environment. And now he was saying, you know, we at JPL have figured out, we have this mandate, we got to do it faster, cheaper. And so what we're going to do is we're going to first drill a little hole through 6 feet of ice in the Arctic Ocean, throw a little robot down there, have it swim around. If it can't find bacteria, we're not going to go to Mars with the thing or go to Europa with the thing. It's kind of a throwback to the Viking lander, where they, you know, dug a trench and they analyzed the soil to see if there was light chemistry going on. But when that same craft was tested in the Mojave Desert, they couldn't find life there. So if you can't find life, not much life in the Mojave Desert, but there's a lot more than there's ever going to be on Mars. So, but anyway, I thought that was real encouraging, that that's really the right way to go about this is, let's see if we can make this work. And by the way, I was amazed to discover that these kinds of experiments have never been done in the Arctic Ocean. For example, all the steam vent research, it's all done in just the Pacific. And one guy asked, you know, here we're all interested in the steam vent life, but we've never gone to the Arctic to see if it's there, or the Antarctic. And yet we're thinking this might be something going on Mars or Europa. Let's go to some environments we have here on Earth and see what's going on. You know, if nothing's going on, then that's going to tell us something. And again, that's really a good, effective way to spend the taxpayers' money. Well, I mean, from NASA's point of view, you really want to make your mistakes on Earth, not on Europa and Mars. If you make too many mistakes, the taxpayer will start saying, gee, maybe we shouldn't give you so much money. So just from their own monetary interests, that's really and that's what this guy from JPL said. He said, you know, if we don't use this approach in doing this origin of life research, eventually the taxpayer is going to say, you know, you guys are now unemployed. So, yeah, last question.
The issue of human oxygen the ocean,
I don't think so, Greg, because the scenario is this, that the water content of planet Earth has not changed. what has changed is the shape of the Earth's crust. So today we have deeper oceans and higher mountains than what existed 4 billion years ago. And so the quantity of water is the same. The oxygen production from radioactivity is now less. It's less because those radiometric elements have decayed considerably over the past 4 billion years. So what's really the factor now is photosynthetic process. I was going to get into this today, which was the limited water supply problem for why the flood can't be global, because the Bible tells us how much water we're talking about, puts a limit on how much extra water there could be there. And the real problem is that if you want a global flood, then you have to do really dramatic things to the Earth's crust, and you have to do it very quickly. And the level of drama really is extreme. We're talking 60,000 feet of plate tectonics in just a few months. That's vertical feet. Now, in addition to that, you'd be having to move stuff around by thousands of miles horizontally. So you talk about thousands of miles of horizontal tectonics and 60,000 feet of vertical tectonics. I think most of you have experienced at least one magnitude 6 earthquake where we're talking just a couple of centimeters to realize that this isn't going to work. Because the text tells us Noah survives. It tells us the ocean survives and the atmosphere survives. And that situation is not going to happen. Hey, now that Tom has left, I'd better pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had. Lord, it's really opening of our eyes to see what happens at the secular science research conferences. And Lord, I pray that you'd open up the eyes of the researchers there to realize that science needs to be more open in its philosophy about causes. And Lord, I ask that as we write this Origin of Life book, that you would guide us in such a way that would help open up the eyes of those that are on the cutting edge of Origin of Life research. And that we would really see a paradigm shift taking place in this discipline akin to what's happened in evolutionary biology with the Cambrian explosion and other such discoveries, that you would be recognized for who you are, that you wouldn't be hidden by the creation that you've made, but you would be fully exposed. So, Lord, help us to be humble as we develop this research and writing. And I pray, too, for humility amongst the Origin of Life researchers, that they would recognize that you're not so hidden, that you're there, you're speaking to them, you're speaking to them to their research. Help them to listen, help them to submit. In Jesus' name, amen.